I'd like today to do two things mainly. One is to make some remarks about the book by Hall, to continue my discussion of the book by Hall, and then to, in the second hour, try to talk to the point of the topic that is given for the last lecture of the course, how to behave as though you had once had a course in general semantics. And if my voice begins to give out, I'll try to lead discussion. But somehow I think we'll get through all right. The voice is much better today. I think that the example of the way we teach our children to react toward their language, especially the way we do this in the schools, is one of the most interesting and obvious examples that we have of an intentional orientation that we've been talking about all semester. A non-functional kind of thinking, a sort of flying in the face of some pretty obvious facts or realities. It oughtn't to be necessary to review these. We're all old enough to have made these observations, but I'm afraid that language is still being taught in the schools as though these observations have never been made. On page 192 of Hall's book, in the chapter in which he is talking about the learning of your own language, he presents some assumptions that we seem to operate with in teaching languages. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. First assumption is that the child who comes to school at the age of six does not know his own language. Isn't this an amazing assumption? In the meantime, there has been a very great deal of, in addition to the observations everybody can make, who's ever been around a child growing up, in addition to this, we have a great deal of data about language development, which has been published in journals and books that are available to anyone who wants to inform himself. And these data, in addition to the ordinary observations everyone can make, certainly would not in any way justify the assumption that the child on entering school does not know his own language. He's been speaking it for several years. He's been speaking essentially the language that he will always speak. It has the same structure. He has learned most of the individual words that he will use to say three-fourths of everything he will ever say. What he will add from then on will be refinements and technical terminologies or special terminologies, specialized terminology. The second assumption is that the standard language is something which can be set up as an absolute and taught on the basis of authority, either some dictionary, the authority of some dictionary, or grammar book, or just on the teacher's say-so. Well, I labored this a little the other day, so I won't express my exasperation anymore about that. that the point is here, well, who would have such authority? What would authority mean in such a case? I don't mean to be advocating the overthrow of all authority. I merely think it is important that one inquire as to the basis of authority whenever authority seems to assert itself. What does authority consist of in each case in which we assume there is authority? In this case, you see, we are almost always dealing with some teacher or some book which seems to take unto itself the prerogative of asserting what is the right thing to do. Without any very clear explanation as to what makes it right. And in general, the language is taught as being correct, provided it is used in conformity with the usage of some supposedly elite group, some supposedly proper group who somehow knows how to use the language right. And so if you will model yourself after those people, then you will be right. But who are those people? You say, well, the great writers. Well, who are the great writers? Which ones did you have in mind? Besides, they are writers. And as Hall asked, do you really want to speak great literature? Another assumption is that any variation from the standard language as defined in the preceding paragraph, that is by some authority, is bad English. And all variations are to be condemned. I don't want to label these. I want to take a little time to talk about that last one and then go on. You are aware, no doubt, from your own experience and observation that there are again some data, of the fact that a large proportion, it turns out when you do research on it, to be approximately 90% of college freshman students acknowledge stage fright. Some kind of comparable figure would hold for those who express a fear of mathematics. Something like this would also describe the proportion who, while they may not have something comparable to stage fright in severe form, do not like to write, do not feel they know how. They take very little pleasure in it. And if they have to, it can be anxiety producing. And occasionally, I have known students who would get writer's cramps. The arm would become immobile. (Clears throat) The same thing tends to be true for reading. It is very difficult to say how many of our people have difficulty with reading. It's hard to define difficulty. If you mean they can't keep up with the average student, well, then about half of them are having difficulty because the average falls somewhere near the median in such sense. If you mean that in the school situation the student is far enough behind that it is tending to produce anxieties and to make for inefficiencies and low grades and discouragement and changing the person's whole pattern of life, something like 10 to 20% probably are having that kind of difficulty in reading. How do you account for all of this misery, inefficiency, and what might well be thought of as essentially wasted human resources? Do you think it has anything to do with the way we teach language? Do you think it doesn't have? Do you think you can defend the way we teach languages in the face of all these observations? What do you think about it? Moreover, many of you are going to teach. What are you going to do about it? Anything? You're just going to make some more stage-frightened people? You do it, you know, by convincing the person that he can't talk right. That's how you do it. You convince a person that he isn't able to write the language by using a red pencil to mark all the mistakes he makes when he tries to. Pointing out all the things he does that are deviations from somebody's standard. You wouldn't deliberately, you're too kind to set out to do that kind of harm to children. You knew you were doing it. You've learned, we make a great to-do over whether or not we ought to use physical punishment for children in school. I think that's almost a picayune-ish issue compared to this one. You couldn't do nearly as much harm with a stick, no matter how much you use it seems to me, as you do with the concept that we call correctness. You produce more misery in a day with this than you could with a hickory stick in a year. Here, it seems to me, comes down to this, and this is a way of thinking about not only this matter, but many, many others. The big issue comes down to whether we evaluate the language behavior, what people do when they talk or write or read, the language behavior of people in a functional way or a formal way. What do you value? The form, the correctness, as you call it? Or are you interested in how the language functions for the user of it, in the effect on him? and on others with whom he is trying to interact, to communicate. You can, if you're going to evaluate a person's language in a formal way, you will be looking for the, what you call the mistakes he makes. You will be noticing how he pronounces words, and whether he pronounces them the way you do or the way you think they should be pronounced. You will be noticing whether he makes all his verbs agree with his nouns and so forth. Whether he uses words as though they were adjectives or adverbs. You'll make a great to-do over whether the cigarette tastes good, like it should, or as it should. And this will become a national issue. Enough to make you weep. If you care about anything that is important, that has to do with language behavior, that isn't important. In fact, if I would say that the advertising man has all the better of the argument there. He's communicating. And this is, you, when you say that, you are evaluating the language behavior in a functional way. You are wondering about how it functions, how it works, what effects come about. Did you read the example he gave, Hall gave in his book of the doctor? Something of a purist in the way he used words referring to bodily functions, and he kept asking the patient whether he defecated, and he said no, and he cracked him. He almost killed the man before he got around to using the right word. Now, what's the sense of this? Can be a matter of life and death. It has nothing to do with morals or nicety. It's just damn foolishness to have this kind of an attitude toward language that keeps you from being helpful to a patient. Well, you ought to be ready after a course in general semantics to take rather easily to a functional approach to anything, including language. Some of the main considerations that arise out of this approach is, first of all, and probably almost the major consideration from the point of view of learning to use a language comfortably and to take delight in it and to enjoy talking, writing, listening, reading, is to know why it is that you would change the way you say something. Why would you? In order to conform to the grammar book? In order to conform to somebody's authoritarian standard? You know, from functional point of view, you would adapt to the speech community in which you're functioning. It's very good to learn how to speak anywhere, and this includes learning how to speak among those who speak English according to whatever may be the so-called accepted standard in the best English departments today. Good idea to be able to speak that language. You may meet up now and then with people who speak it. You won't very often, but when you do, it's nice to be able to speak with them, to adapt to them. And it isn't that you are going to adapt completely to any of your listeners. To begin with, I don't believe you could. You can find yourself in some speech communities in southwest Louisiana and eastern Tennessee. I doubt if you could carry it off. I don't think you could talk the way those people do unless you lived with them for several months. You'd have a little difficulty, I think, talking in some of the communities in Iowa, or Kansas, that I know. And if you tried to adapt completely to them, they would know that you're a phony, and that you're just trying to be like they are, when you really aren't like they are. And so, it isn't that you're going to adapt completely to everybody you talk to. But if you're a doctor, you're going to adapt to save a person's life. If you're going to work on a construction job, you're going to learn to swear. You'd better. And you would be pretty foolish if you didn't. Ordinarily, you might be the odd one now and then who would be accepted anyway. It'd be pretty rare. The point is that you would be adapting for functional reasons, in order to facilitate communication, in order to improve your relationships with people, in order to get a job done more effectively. You wouldn't be adapting your language to some kind of a non-functional, disembodied sort of standard that nothing to do with the situation you're in. Sometimes, in order not to violate, to weaken or to worsen relationships which you have to violate grammar. And you wouldn't hesitate to, from a functional point of view. There's nothing sacred about it. And I think it is a shame that you can't have more latitude than you have in the schoolroom in the way you use English or your language. Because here you're adapting to people who may not themselves always speak the English that they are teaching, but who are at least trying to teach it. And so you are having to adapt to a very special kind of user of your language. And I think that the educational program would be richer and better, more valuable, if it permitted you or made it possible and necessary for you to adapt to a much wider variety of usages of the language. Just a few words about scientific linguistics. What I think is especially important about it is that it is essentially democratic. Imposition of a standard of some elite group upon all the people is a profoundly undemocratic way to behave. We do something like this almost by choice with regard to fashions. We don't have to, and there are many people who manage to avoid a slavish adaptation to fashion and are very comfortable. Our society permits considerable latitude. But you have in the matter of fashions in clothes, for example, a pretty good analog to idea that there is a right way to use English, correct English. This is a fashion. Now, in both cases, it is important, I think, to ask where do the fashions come from? Who says that women are going to wear birds in their hats next year? And by what authority? Who gets away with this? I have tried to look into this a bit, and up to now I'm simply puzzled by it. Evidently, any one of you, if you were sufficiently audacious and intelligent in a cunning kind of way, and wanted to do this, could go to New York or Paris or London, maybe even Dallas, and announce over the proper kind of stationery, with the proper kind of stationery, or with the proper kind of a public relations representative, with the proper staging, I think you too could tell the women of the United States what, how high they're going to wear their dresses next year. I don't know who could keep you from it. I don't quite understand all you have to do to get away with it. But people who do are very often, one thing that puzzles you when you look into it is that some of these men who are announcing what the styles are going to be turn out to be 22 years old. How did they find out so soon? Well, this can very easily be reduced to an absurdity, and so can the idea that there is language correctness be reduced to the same absurdity. And it is essentially a kind of undemocratic way to do things. On the one hand, you can be undemocratic from the point of view of the teacher of English or the hairstyling authority. You will act like an autocrat. You will act as though you had authority that you simply do not have. And you can behave democratically from the point of view of the consumer or the student and act as though you did not have rights, which you certainly do have. And I think that we have obligations from both points of view. There are some remarks to be made, I think, that are pretty important in some instances concerning the relation of what we call spoken language and written language. Of course, Hall maintains that all language is speech, and writing is simply the marks you make with your fist, as he says. They are simply consist of a set of symbols for symbolizing speech, that the language is basically spoken. Well, here we can exercise the democratic privilege of making the words mean what we want them to mean. And so if we want to talk about written language, we can. But I do think we need to develop much more of an understanding than most of us seem to have about the difference between speaking and what we call written language or writing. We recognize somehow that there's a difference. If we didn't, well, a lot of things would be different. We wouldn't have lectures like this. Why come to hear a horse professor when you can read something? What do you come for? Oh, you say you're required to. Well, why do you go to hear anybody talk? If the written language and the spoken language are the same, why bother? It's easier to read, isn't it? You know there's a difference. I'm often asked to, when I lecture, and the people who conduct the program, tape record my lecture, they ask me naively whether they can publish it. I used to worry about this, but I don't much anymore, because hardly ever do they go through with it. They begin to type up this mess. And it obviously is so difficult to edit into anything that anybody would want to read that they give up. Almost never do I get a second letter about it. So I've learned not to worry about it. But I have on occasion come up against a very persistent person, and I've had to help edit a tape, and I tell you, it's much easier to start from scratch and actually write a manuscript. The spoken speaking is not writing. When you are writing, you depend on various things you do to hold attention of an isolated individual. And when you are confronting an audience, it's an entirely different situation. You do other things to keep in relationship with people who are looking at you. And you do it not just with your mouth, but with your hands and body and face, and you are thinking out loud. It's very different, I think, and people often make what I would call a mistake when they prepare a manuscript ahead of time and then they read it and call that a speech. That's not speaking. That's reading a manuscript. Entirely different. You don't do things like this when you're reading a manuscript. So you don't communicate the same thing, see? You don't communicate a person trying to think his way through. And that's what's exciting, isn't it? Don't you like to think with the person? Well, if he's already thought it all out, all he's doing now is just intoning it. There's nothing for you to do except listen, hear. But you see, you're, in this case right now, you and I are both making this speech. As far as I'm concerned, I'm responding to you. I would never write like this. Well, Hall would contend that these are almost two entirely different things. That the emphasis in education upon the writing is a source of great misfortune. That the emphasis should be upon spoken language in the schools. It's interesting that many of the older and supposedly more respectable colleges, some of the Ivy League schools, don't teach speech at all. And I think this is one of their greatest weaknesses. It represents, I think, a rather profound misunderstanding of the symbolic functions. That language is important, and the most important thing about it is the speaking of it. The spoken relationships between people are especially significant. And education generally neglects them. Somehow we have gotten the evaluations Hall makes turned upside down in our official educational policy. So that the writing is more important. Students do much more writing as a rule than they do talking. And if you saw this year how hard it has been to, or at least for me, to activate a panel and get some good talking going. And I think the very fact that it's been so difficult is a kind of evidence of the need for it. I think we need to ask ourselves a little bit about why it is that language changes. Language changes, and this is one of the very most important facts about it. This is what frightens many people and disturbs them. So when the New International Dictionary comes out, they're all upset because it has new words in it, new meanings of old words, and new pronunciations, and the language, they say, is going to pop. Well, it's been going to pot ever since the first grunt, if that's going to pot, because it has been changing, and it's still changing, and change is one of the most important facts about language. Why is this? How does it change? I think one of the most interesting aspects of this, one of the big generalizations here, is that of generalization. Analogic change, that is, we start to form plurals in a certain way by adding S to word. And then we generalize this, and pretty soon we're forming almost all plurals this way. Although not all of them. It will take us time, I suppose, to get around to changing mice to mouses. But we'll probably do it eventually because of the analogic tendency. These exceptions become very, very conspicuous. And we will say deers instead of deer. What's the plural of moose? Mooses? It's neither mooses nor meese. It's moose. It still sounds like the singular. And of course, this would be the simplest. But the point is that these exceptions tend to document a kind of change or principle of change, which is that of generalization by analogy, making larger and larger the class of words or forms which are treated in the same way. We tend to overgeneralize, and we tend to extend our generalizations in almost all respects. We abstract, you see, and the abstracting tends to go beyond useful functional limits. Another one of the principles which seems to be involved in change in language is a kind of operant conditioning. That is, you reinforce the responses that are made, the language responses of people that conform to the standards that someone wants to maintain. Teachers who teach what they call correct English are reinforcing only certain responses, and in this way bringing about a conformity to a model. Well, if it were only teachers doing this, the language may not change as much as it does, but there are other people doing it too. There are heroes, there are characters, celebrities that we tend to model after. I don't suppose he is the model now that he once was, but Bing Crosby and his patter was, when I was considerably younger, and so was Bing, quite a source of operant conditioning, as it were. And the young adolescent was greatly reinforced by talking like Bing, for talking like Bing. And so we change in part because we model after persons. Sometimes these models are a source of dismay to the English teachers. I think that Harry Truman was a source of dismay to some English teachers. But he was a model. He was the president. Some of Eisenhower's language during the press conferences, I think, was a source of dismay to English teachers. And sometimes all you could do to find a sentence in one of those, one of the press conferences. And so the models can be of all kinds. There's another rather interesting principle that you can call the law of least effort. There's certain changes, first of all, of a general sort. If you compare the writing of Thackeray and especially Fenimore Cooper with the writing of, let's say, Hemingway, you get the feeling for what I'm talking about. There is a simplification. The sentences are shorter. The words are shorter. All the rigmarole that authors used to put in the dialogue was almost reduced by Hemingway to one word. He said. As this kind of an operation of the law of least effort, you sort of do away with the gimcrackery. And this also affects single words. We go from gasoline to gas, from automobile to car, and so on throughout the language. There is this reduction in the length and the complexity of words and forms. And this you can count on. is continuing far into the future. We have to reckon today with certain other factors which make for change. We have the large networks, TV and radio. And it turns out to be commercially advantageous to use a kind of standard American. So no matter whether the program is coming from Miami or New York or Dallas or Seattle, it sounds about the same. And certain dialects survive in this kind of a competition, and others don't. There's some other factors. I just have time. Well, if some of you have the class at 4:30, I was about to summarize some of the reasons why the reactions to the New International Dictionary were the way they were. They were, again, had to do with some of these factors having to do with language change and resistance to it. But I believe we've got to take a 5-minute break or so, and those of you who need to go now can, with the publication of the newest edition of the International Dictionary, the Merriam-Webster International Dictionary, there was a tremendous outpouring of outrage, dissatisfaction, because this dictionary was different from the second edition, which people were used to. This, I think, was part of the reason for the reaction. People were being asked to change their habits, so far as they have any, have to do with the use of dictionary. But the reactions were so great that it seemed essential to try to analyze them. And recent analysis has been made. I had the reprint with me. I was over at the hospital just before this hour, the class met, and the physician referred me down to the pharmacy to get something. And I sat there reading, and I put the reprint over on the table. So somebody over there at the hospital is now reading about the Third International Dictionary, I suppose, and I can't remember the name of the author of an article in the Journal of the American Association of University Professors, which is quite a staid journal for an article like this to be in the first place. The author assigned himself the task of trying to analyze the reasons for the violent reaction to the Third International. I thought he had some rather interesting points to make, which helped to extend what I have been talking about. Now, one of them is that the editor of the New International, whose name I have a terrible time remembering, Goff? Koff? Do you know? Anyway, he's the first editor of a dictionary like this who has been a professional lexicographer, dictionary maker. The editors of the edition before were linguistic scholars, but they were not professional lexicographers. And so this accounts for part of the difference in the two editions and part of the reaction. But this is rather minor. Another possibly minor that is not specific to this situation and yet perhaps an important reason is that we're living in an age of change that is very great, and we're seeing great many types of reaction to this. And in a time of great change, people who do tend to feel insecure, anxious, tend to become very conservative and to try to resist any more change. They've had it. They don't want any more change. They want to get back to something simple, something that they can feel secure with. And so they're threatened by innovation, by change, by new theories of government, or anything of this sort. We're witnessing now, and this is, as far as I'm concerned, objective kind of statement, observation. We're witnessing this kind of reaction, I think, in the resurgence of the conservative point of view in politics. It's kind of comforting to think in terms of something simple. Now, of course, you analyze the situation, it's rather baffling to see how anything can be made out of it that would be simple. But it is easy to talk about it as though it could be made simple. And this is very appealing to people who find it difficult to keep up with change. So part of the reaction to the new edition of International is possibly explainable on this basis. But again, this is probably not specific to the dictionary and not important. There are a couple other things that probably were especially important. And one of them arises out of the fact that scientific linguistics is quite new in our culture. There are not very many people who know much about it. The standards of the scientific linguist are not widespread. Now, in this specific instance, this took this form, in part. And when the Atlantic Monthly, New Yorker, other publications, the New York Times Book Review, when the editors of these publications were looking about for someone to review the new edition of the International Dictionary, they were thinking like commercial editors. And they wanted to pick someone to write the review who would write something that would be in the mode of their readers. And so they picked reviewers who were rather typical of our culture. And they were not scientific linguists. They were educated people. That is, they'd been to college. They were people who wrote and they read. One of the most outspoken was Joseph Wood Crooch, who is quite a gentleman, but doesn't seem to know much about scientific linguistics. And these people write well, and so they sort of thrashed up a storm because they were such good writers, and they were writing from a point of view that was not scientific. And the editors of the New International were scientific linguists. And so there was a great clash. And it got highlighted because of the way the reviewers were picked. And there's another basic fact, and this has a great deal to do with the whole problem of language change. Back in 1933, I think it was, when the second edition of the New International was published, the number of university and college professors in the United States was something like 65,000. In 1959 or 60, 61, whenever this one was published, the number was about 10 times that. maybe not quite 10 times, was approaching 400,000. That wasn't 10 times. The number of college graduates between these two dates increased by something like 5 or 6 times. Moreover, the number of persons who were engaged in the knowledge business, in information dissemination, in publication, in television and radio, who were somehow professional word users, had tremendously increased. And the number of people who listen to them and who read what they say had greatly increased. Now, if you're going to mean by correct English, as the classical linguist tends to mean, as the persons who contend that there is a correctness to English, they contend, well, they usually mean the usage of the educated users of the language. Well, it's a little difficult to define the educated users of the language, but in terms of the usage which goes on, the number of persons who have been to college who are educated in at least one rather obvious sense of the word, and who use language professionally, having been to college, is so great, and these individuals are so varied, that there has been in the English language in the last generation roughly relatively more change than there ever had been before. When you get a lot of persons who have been to college using the language professionally in advertising, on the radio, and in various ways, in sales, so on. They're educated users of the language. And they are not linguistic scholars. And they do begin to use words in ways that are different from the usage of the grammarian. They say that Mary is different than Alice. And they say this so often that it becomes practically standard usage. Now, of course, semantically, it's a little difficult to make any sense out of this. How can something be different than? Because than refers to a comparative. Something can be more than, it can be less than, but different than is kind of ambiguous. But, so it makes more sense one who is used to this kind of usage to say different forms. Well, it's this kind of change, and the like and the as. Cigarette tastes good like a cigarette, which of course is wrong from the point of view of the purist. But these are the kinds of changes that you get when you get large numbers of people who are more or less educated, who are using the language, but they are not so addicted to what is called grammatical correctness that they are embarrassed by these usages. And they're educated. And pretty soon, when you come along and you take a sampling of the educated usage, you find that it includes terms like different than, And this is part of the reason for the outrage, because the scientific linguist simply comes along and notes the usage and doesn't try to legislate for the universe. This is what people are saying. Very great many things like this that people are saying, because there are so many of them talking, so many of them using language professionally, who are educated. Well, there is so much more to say, of course, about linguistics, and far more than I could say. I do think this is a rather good way to bring the course to a kind of focus at the end, to having learned how to talk about language to some degree at least, having learned how to talk about the symbolization process as it plays a role in the abstracting process. Now, take this new language and talk about language with it. Try to be scientific in what you say about language itself and what you observe about it. And Paul's book may possibly help you a little bit to at least make a beginning in doing that. There's a great deal going on these days in this area. I noticed the other day, looking through the catalog, a number of courses now in the English department here that would be very exciting to take that have to do with linguistics. Well, this question of how to act as though you have once had a course in general semantics, I suppose, sounds a little bit facetious, but I mean it in a serious way. There is it is a question or a statement which tends to reflect or is designed to reflect a functional point of view with regard to education. What do you study for? What do you take a course for? I think it is probably worthwhile to evaluate any course that you've ever had in this way. How would you act if you were going to act as though you had once had a course in the psychology of adjustment? What would you do from now on that you hadn't done before? And if you wouldn't do anything from now on that you hadn't done before, what did you take the course for? I don't mean to ask that as though you couldn't possibly answer the question. There are other kinds of reasons for taking the course. I don't think they're particularly obvious, but they exist. How would you act as though you had had a course in calculus? I wonder how many people do. And so on around the university. I think it would be very, very good for education as a whole if we were to evaluate courses this way. And I think the fact that we are doing some evaluating like this is the reason why we are getting, for instance, new mathematics courses and new ways of teaching foreign languages. How do you act as though you had had a course in French? Well, you talk French, don't you? And how many people do? You watch this, what looks like inefficiency and waste over a long enough time, and you begin to think, there might be another way to do this. Maybe we could get some students talking French. If not, what are we doing? Here, I think it would be quite difficult to justify the courses at all. Why study foreign languages if you're not going to use the languages? This is not a very good way to study the literature of the country and the history of it. I don't see any. I suppose I'm maverick, but to the great demand for teaching more foreign languages, I react very coldly. I think nothing could be more foolish than to waste more time than we're already wasting doing this. Unless someone comes along and really can demonstrate how you teach foreign languages so that people end up using them. If not, they'd much better spend their time doing something else. I think it's not only wasteful, but it's harmful. It tends to make for bad habits, sort of an attitude of discouragement, general addiction to useless things. And it's not good at all. I'd abandon the foreign languages until someone can demonstrate to me he can teach them. And I think that everybody who teaches ought to try, as best he can, to evaluate what he does from this kind of functional point of view. Well, are you behaving any differently because you've had a course in general semantics? If not, you wasted your time and I've wasted mine. You ought to be behaving differently now. If you're not behaving differently now, then what assurance can you give yourself that you ever will? Why should you or I or anyone else predict that you're going to begin behaving differently 6 months from now? What are you doing differently? Do you do you experience resentment just as often as you ever did? Well, you shouldn't be. You should be delaying those reactions. You should be indulging in the kind of evaluative reactions which will tend to counteract resentment. You should be, instead of resenting what people say or do to you or about you, you should be spending much more time very actively trying to be understanding of them. Wondering about why the other person feels the way he does instead of having sort of infantile feelings of your own. Do you find yourself as often as ever either accepting or rejecting a whole book, a whole movie, a whole political candidate, a whole person? Have you begun to think about yourself and other persons using the population model, the statistical model, so that you are reacting only to a sampling and not to John? Undated, unindexed, unsampled. If you're not, You wasted your time. So have I. Are you any more conscious of abstracting than you were? And how can you tell? You're using more terms like, as I see it, from my point of view, as far as I know, but then, of course, my knowledge is limited. I really never have been there myself. Are you saying things like this? Are you having just as many experiences as ever in conversations with people you never met before, in which you feel awkward because you don't know the answer to something? You think you should know everything? You feel this way as much as you ever did? If so, you've wasted your time. You shouldn't feel that way anymore. Do you find yourselves still preferring speakers who sound very positive, who have no black, who have no grays in their thinking, all blacks and whites? You can tell what they're for because they're sure for it. Mm-hmm. You like that kind of person, do you? You wasted your time. You should be on to such people by now. You should see through them. You should be understanding of them. They're kind of sick. You ask yourself just as many meaningless questions as you ever did. Questions for which there are no observations that could possibly be made that would be relevant. And you worry about this thing. You wasted your time. You should be over that. Such questions shouldn't worry you. You should be able to recognize sound in its pure form. This is one that you might have some objection to. You're going to sell your textbooks this semester, as usual. You wasted your time. Haven't you started building a library? Aren't you going to have a special shelf in your home for your old college textbooks? So you can have a tangible demonstration for your children of why you're behaving the way you are. When you register this next semester, you're going to be just as likely as ever to base your choices. Of course, you don't have many choices, I realize. You have to take so many required courses that someone else thinks are good for you that you can't exercise very much judgment while you're still in college. But so far as you have any opportunity to exercise judgment, how will you exercise it? You're going to just be just as likely as you ever were before you took the course to base your choices on what you like, what you're interested in. Aren't you going to, if you have a choice between two courses you can take and the one you don't like and the one you've already learned to like, you're going to take the one you don't like, aren't you? If you got a choice between two, the one you're interested in, you've already learned to be interested in that. The other you're not interested in, well, you're going to take the one you're not interested in, aren't you? Otherwise, you wasted your time. You don't learn anything here. You don't want to just burrow deeper into your own rut. Get out of your rut and see the world. You have a choice between taking a course in American history or European history and Asian history. Well, of course you'll take the Asian history, won't you? Otherwise you're wasting your time in a course like this that leaves you still in the same old groove. This course is supposed to stimulate your interest in making observations and being adventurous and exploring and trying to become more acquainted with the nonverbal levels. And so the way you can tell what courses to take is, don't take the ones you like. Don't take the ones you're interested in. Don't take any that are like the ones you had before. Don't take any that are anywhere near your major. Get as far away from it as you can. Now, if you are behaving as though you had had a course once in general semantics, that's what you'll do. Coming up. If you behave as though you've never had a course in general semantics, you will know now, you will know early who you're going to vote for, and you won't listen to the other candidate. If you act as though you've had a course in general semantics, you listen to the candidate who at first you didn't think you were interested in. You listen. Well. Very well. And you may end up voting for the one you wanted the first time. But that, if you do, it'll be a different kind of vote. It'll be an informed vote. Now, these are some details. I think one of the ways that one acts as though he had once had a course in general semantics, almost all these things are little picayune-ish details. It's hard to pick on any one thing. It sounds very big. It adds up to a rather enormous total, I think. It has to do with the way you react to people. The person who behaves in such a way that we say or he feels that he is shy is acting as though he'd never had a course in general semantics, from one point of view. If he's acting as though he had once had a course in general semantics, he wouldn't be shy. He wouldn't be withholding. He wouldn't be withdrawing. He would be eagerly exploring. He would be trying to get to know people. He would be asking them who they are and where they've been, where they're from, what they're doing, and so forth, and getting to know them. They'd be awkward at first, but they get good at it after a while and end up being the kind of people who get, persons who get to know people easily. And if you continue to sort of keep to yourself and don't talk to your seat neighbor on the bus, and want to bring into the sorority only girls like you and not those who are very different from you, and so on. Well, then you're acting as though you never had a course in general semantics. If you go into a very, very good restaurant in New Orleans or San Francisco or Boston and order a sirloin steak, well, you're acting as though you never had a course in general semantics. 5 days and eat the same thing twice, you're acting as though you never had a kosher dinner for me. If you know before you examine a book whether you like to read it, you're acting as though you never had a kosher dinner for me. If you say, no, I'm not going to watch that television show, I don't like Westerns. Even that, I think that's a pretty extreme example. I saw one the other night that was very moving, about some pioneers who had an invasion of locusts. You see that? I lived under very pioneering conditions in the Indian tribe. My mother lived as a little girl in Kansas, just over the hill from the Indian tribe. We used to come and, you know, borrow sugar. And they had a locust invasion, so I was very moved by this. If I had had the attitude, now I'm never going to look westward, I'd have missed it. So even though this is a very extreme example, I think it's a good one. There's something very important to say in this connection. Complicated. If you behave as though you once had a kosher dinner for manage, you're rather evaluative. You're asking a lot of what do you mean and how do you know and so what and what difference does it make and if it is so, what else is so and what should we do about it, etc. And so you sort of insist on things being sensible, but this you can carry to the point where you're not only a bore, but you're stupid. Because part of the reality is that you're also going to have a very great appreciation of if you behave as though you'd once had a kosher dinner for manage. Are the kinds of experience that we call feelings. That very often, in the ordinary sense of the word, can't be made very sensible. If you behave as though you had had a course in general semantics, you're likely not only to laugh more often and a little more heartily, because so many things in those dreams are funny. But you're also probably going to cry more, too. And you're going to get misty-eyed more often than usual, probably. And your voice is going to choke up at times. You get to that sort of silent level where there are no words at all. And nothing but sobs. And so it isn't that you are going to act as though you were all brains and be some kind of a brilliant idiot. Great appreciation of people who are emotional geniuses. And there are some. And they're very often dressed in overalls. And you will have, I think, a much deeper feeling for the fact than you may have had before. That we have never been very successful in understanding intelligence. And that certainly it is ridiculous to think that you have indicated what it is by measuring somebody's IQ. You should remove the wonder about the fact that in institutions for the mentally ill, you find some very high IQs. And these people with these very high IQs are not intelligent enough to get along outside. And I think if you behave as though you had once had a course in dental semantics, you will also behave as though you had gained a much deeper appreciation of the fact that we've never been very successful in telling ourselves what we mean by an education. What mostly we mean by education is so bookish and so verbal and so Aristotelian and intentional as to be ludicrous. And some of the most unpleasant people in the world are the most cultured. Among the people who have very cultivated voices are also some of the very most highly cultivated tempers. It just isn't true that the people who have read the best books and seen the best paintings and heard the best operas and performed in them are the best people. It just isn't true. There isn't that kind of correlation. You wouldn't want to go fishing, necessarily, with a great violinist. You wouldn't want him around any longer than just to play the violin and get out. Getting all of that culture has not made him into a fine human being. It doesn't follow. That isn't how you necessarily become the kind of a person someone would want to marry and live with.
Seen him for a while, and I asked him about it. He said, "Yeah, he had developed a hypothesis, and it turned out to be a good one." He said that he decided that he was going to try as hard as he possibly could to make sense of the cigarette commercials. He was going to pay attention to them, listen hard, and ask himself, what's the man saying? What is he saying? What's this about? And he said the hypothesis was that he might just possibly find that the day had arrived when he had done this to one too many commercials. And it did. He tried until he was sort of satiated with meaninglessness. And somehow the problem just kind of fell apart. He lost all desire to have another one of those things. The commercial just made no sense when he listened for sense. But how many do? You see, the person who writes the commercials can be pretty sure that nobody will do that. Or almost nobody. There are not very many high commas. You don't have to write ads for them. But, this is, too, is a kind of application of the extensionalization principle. What are the words related to? Is the basic thing you're asking. You say you have to stutter. What are you talking about? You have to have another smoke. What are you talking about? You can't wear anything blue. What are you talking about? Etc. 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 You wonder where it would end if you were to be thorough about it. Well, let's get on to the next slide, Augie, and we have a few minutes left today. This a way to approach take a good look at it, don't turn the lights back. A way to approach the problems involved in the way we use language, we're getting into now the disorders of abstracting, by way of taking a look at the language we use and what kinds of effects the language itself might have. As I said in one of the very first times we met, we tend to assume that the language is perfect, and if there is a miscommunication among us, it's because somebody goofed. There could be nothing wrong with the language. Well, there can be a lot wrong with the language, and this is what I want to look into for a while now. As I said, I believe yesterday, the last time, we can't get back to the origins of language and do any first-order observing. We have to do the best we can by inference from what we do know on the basis of the observations we are able to make. The best I can do is to infer that the ancient, relatively uninformed persons, by our standards, devised, first of all, a language of the self. This is a language which was designed to represent what we call feelings and likes and dislikes and aspirations and fears and hopes and the inner life. It was a language of the self. But early, the individual learned to distinguish between himself, his self, and others. But he talked about these others now with the same language, as though their selves were like his self.